Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Cluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper, Ronald J. Martin. Boys, we've been in the midst of a series. I think it's because you guys are men of the cloth. You know, we're in that, not a sermon series, a different kind of series. We've been talking about generations. And this morning, boys, we get to talk about what some have called the greatest generation. And it's Generation X. So we'll get to do some kind of backward-looking remembrances of Generation X and all their achievements and all the great things about this amazing generation. But first, in true Gen X fashion, we got to make some money. We got to pay some bills. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, boys, we're back. Talked about millennials last time. Talked about Gen Z a couple of weeks before that. This week, we're talking about Gen X, and I want to kind of frame it in a similar way as we framed the other ones, in first asking what are the most sort of iconic Gen X movies and what makes them Gen X. So when you think about like movies that define our generation, Big R, what comes to mind?
Oh man, that's a great question. You know, I mean, there's going to be a lot of them, right? Yes. I think of some of the more teen oriented ones like Breakfast Club. Oh, yeah. And you know, things that just sort of, Things that just sort of introduced what it was that kids were facing based on the way that they'd been raised, and then how culture, like you know, music, movies, all of those things kind of informed their life, you know, in that time frame. Yeah. And so, yeah, I think of something like The Breakfast Club, where you got this balance of like characters that weren't that different than what you experienced, you know, at school in that era, you know?
Yeah.
And again, there's so many unrealistic things about it. Of course, it's just a movie, but this sense of like the commonality they all had was this sense of isolation. They had overworked boomer parents that didn't give them a lot of attention, just sort of let them be on their own and figure it out. So they acquired this sort of independence, and yet they were still stuck with the personalities they had, which didn't all sort of like seamlessly fit together, but it did kind of allow them to become more resourceful. And so those are some of the characteristics of Gen X, that isolation, which turned into independence, needing to figure things out on your own because you don't have a lot of mentors in your life. That kind of a thing. And so Breakfast Club is just so interesting because it just kind of brings that out. Ironically enough, I didn't see that movie until way later. So I would have been like a preteen when that movie came out, which was all about whatever 16 and 17 year olds. Yeah. So it was a little past me, you know, but yet when you watch it now, after having lived through some of those periods, you kind of go, it's kind of spot on in some ways, you know?
It really is. I think John Hughes really nailed a lot of things. So he did a lot of these kind of high school movies in the mid to late 80s. And, you know, that movie in particular, I think really got the the kind of feel and the vibe of public high school in the Midwest. And his movies were all set in like the Chicago area. And to your point about overworked boomer parents, they always had amazing houses. And I remember, I remember watching the John Hughes movies and just sort of marveling at like the suburban Chicago house, right? Like Kevin McAllister's dad's house. I'm like, what does Kevin's yes. dad do for a
living? Yeah, they're all rich. They're all uber successful for some reason.
Yeah, dude, they all live in like Wheaton or like Oak Park, and they all do really well, and they go into the city for jobs that are indiscriminate, and they kind of, he didn't lean fully into the sort of, you know, Bill Murray, burned out, disaffected, I'm a drone for a corporation kind of vibe yet. But those dads just did really well financially, and it was kind of an interesting deal. But Pipe, what's your experience with The Breakfast Club? When did you see it, and what did you think about it?
I have never seen it. It came out when really? I was like, so I was born in 1983, so I don't think I'm technically a Gen Xer. I think I'm technically a very old millennial. So that movie came out, I think, when I was like 2 or 3 years old. And so by the time I was of an age that it would have been for me, we had our own generation of teen-ish movies. And they were like they leaned heavily into dumb comedies. Like I was of the Adam Sandler, Chris Farley generation much more than the John Hughes generation.
Yep. Yeah, and those.
And it wasn't one of those ones that they would show at. So like Ferris Bueller's Day Off or Day Out. Yeah. I can never remember which one it is. It's Day Ferris off. Bueller.
Yeah.
That one would get shown at like school events or whatever, ironically. But the John Hughes stuff never really did.
Dude, Ferris Bueller's dad had an iconic house too.
Yep.
And Ferris's friend's dad also had an amazing house.
Cam, was that his name?
Cam. Yeah, Cam. Cam's house was sweet, dude.
His dad was uber successful. And it was also like, it was the celebration of suburbia. That's what Gen X is. Obviously, that's very narrow, right? But that's what you saw in those movies, which was Gen Xers have this suburban experience. And they're starved for attention because their parents are successful boomers who have given them stuff more than they've given them themselves. Yeah, but hey. We got all this stuff, right?
We got all this stuff. We got the sweet house. I never see my dad. I don't know my dad. That wasn't my experience or yours, obviously.
It wasn't actually, yeah. So that's the irony of it, right? But
that was the irony of it. And then there came another wave, Big R, of kind of 90s Gen X movies as like our generation grew up a little bit. You got
coming of age
like,
movies, yeah.
Yeah, well, and you got movies like Singles, right? Yeah. So the Cameron Crowe Seattle thing, everybody's in their first apartment trying to figure it out.
Yeah, Reality Bites.
Reality Bites.
Swingers.
Yeah. I want to make Swingers.
yeah, that was part of it for sure.
Amazing movie, part of our experience, Big R. But I want to make an oddly specific point and see if you guys agree with it vis-a-vis Gen X. So thinking of movies in that genre now, so like the First Apartment type movies, so Reality Bites, Singles, Swingers even, and music videos from that era. Gen X loved like First Apartment squalor and kind of romanticized it. You know what I mean? In that like you're watching that Fiona Apple video and she's laying on like a bare mattress on the floor. You know what I mean? It was kind of squalid and... You know, everybody was kind of romanticizing the struggle of trying to make it.
Yeah.
And this generation that's in college now does not do that. They have no interest in struggle or squalor or romanticizing any of it. They want their First Apartment to look like a Pottery Barn catalog, you know?
That's right. And they're like, what are we, tweakers? We're not living in that dump.
Yeah, exactly. But yet Gen X had this real kind of romantic notion of, you know, grinding it out in the city and like, you know, having to live in kind of squalor, but yet you had those close relationships with people around you. And that was sort of the dream.
Well, it was kind of a response, I think, you know, it was like, it, you know, without putting too fine of a point on it, but I think we saw our boomer parents as just being the ultimate hypocrisy, right? Like they had these ideals that they had completely turned their back on for the sake of like success and you know, financial stability. And
right.
And so I think and then because Gen X got to be able, because they did, you know, these are all generalities, right? Because Gen X didn't get the attention they deserved from their parents. They were put into sort of an observational mode where they could, they just kind of sat back. They had the time to kind of look at what was going on. They also had some, you know, they also had a little bit of privilege, especially if their parents were successful, to have the time to kind of do that. And then when it came time for them to kind of embark on life, I think they had like a deeper awareness of like, hey, we don't want to turn into them. And we have our own ideals too. And there's a way that we can sort of live out our ideals and not end up betraying them or becoming hypocrites because we denied them down the road. And so, yeah, movies like Reality Bites and Singles, it was like, hey, you know what? Like, we can live the life that we want to live. And by the way, the problem with our parents is that the passions and the dreams they had, they ditched those. And we're not going to ditch those. We are going to like live out our passions. Our jobs are going to be our dream jobs. And it doesn't matter if we're living on like a pallet, you know, on the third floor in some like, you know, rented apartment building in downtown Chicago with eight of our friends. If that's what we want to do, that's what success is.
I want to suggest that that idea was absolute crap. And then I want to also suggest, and Pipe, I want to hear you on this. I think that we have absolutely turned into our boomer sellout successful parents.
I mean, not even a question.
Not even a question. Literally everyone I know lives in a nice house in the suburbs.
That's just called adulthood.
So it is. And yet like the 22-year-old version of myself would have been so at odds with like the life that I'm living now. And yet I basically like the life that I'm living now. And it begs the question, what changed? Pipe, what ideas do you have about any of that?
Well, going back to the whole loving squalor thing, I need to figure out generationally where two shows that were seminal in the sort of presenting a generation vibe, where those fit. One is Seinfeld, the other is Friends. Because they both, so Seinfeld launched like what, real early 90s. So that would have been like Gen X teen years, college years. And then Friends was a couple years later, but they basically owned the 90s, especially the second half of the 90s, when Gen X was becoming adults. Those absolutely did not glorify squalor. They had that whole sort of where these people are all very clearly well off, because otherwise how do they have 1,800 square feet in Manhattan?
How do they finance their lifestyles? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But they're, you know, they're clean cut, they're pulled together, at least outwardly, and then it's all, you know, hijinks ensue because they make dumb decisions. Where do those fit generationally?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. You can go back to Breakfast Club to figure this out. So Friends is what Molly Ringwald turned into, right? And the squalor types, right? The other types, you know, that, you know, what's the guy's name? I forget his name in real
Bender.
Life.
Yeah, Bender.
Bender is what you see in Singles and Reality Bites, right? Which is, I mean, they all, you know, 20 years after both those shows, you know, both of those people end up turning out the same. But in their formative years, when they're 20 years old or when they're 21 years old, it just, depending on who you were back in your early mid 80s teen years, it really sort of dictated, Gen X had different kinds of values too. So it wasn't something that was just completely fluid all the way throughout. You could be a Gen X and Bender rejected Molly Ringwald and her sort of like Sochi lifestyle and all of that. But you still see that playing out in the early 90s, you know, with like Reality Bites versus a show like Friends. So again, it was different kinds of worldviews and values, even within Gen X. There was like a diversity there, right, T?
Yeah, I think there was. So, like, in his early 20s, Bender is, like, silkscreening T-shirts for a living and trying to make a band.
Yeah, working at a record store, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Molly Ringwald just went ahead and became a drug rep. You know what I mean? And the Emilio Estevez character is, like, a high school football coach or whatever. So, to your point, though, and it's a good point, Big R, like, 20 years down the road, they're all back in suburbia. They've all arrived at the same place, but, like... the way of getting there is just a little bit different for each of them. Boys, or actually, no, I want to say one more thing on the friend Seinfeld thing, Piper. My feeling even back then was that those two shows were basically about college without the classes. They were a bunch of youngish people who lived together and just hung out and talked about themselves, which is basically college. But in college, you have to go to class in between. So, like, Friends and Seinfeld took away the classes. Like, nobody did anything on Seinfeld. You never saw them, like, going to their jobs except for, like, George and Elaine for a couple minutes. But then they would go to that coffee shop and just talk about themselves.
Yeah, and jobs were a plot device, not the bulk of their life.
100%.
That's right. Yeah, and for us, for any, like, you know, now middle-aged Gen X, moderately successful person, the job is the bulk of your life. And then the thing that you do on the side to make money is the rest of your life. And then, yeah, trying to have a church life and, you know, get to know your kids a little bit. That's like the rest of it. But yeah, the shows were very unrealistic, not only from a financial standpoint, but from a time standpoint. Boys, let's take a break. And then I want to come back and talk about some iconic Gen X people. We'll be right back. All right, boys. I was having this conversation with a couple of students. When you think of Gen X icons, who do you think of? And who do you think of that's still alive? We were talking about, and I don't like this person's music. I find his music very boring. But we were talking about how Dave Grohl has become sort of the Gen X rock star, like, dad figure. Dave Grohl stands in for, like, whatever values you embody. You can superimpose those values over Dave Grohl. He's sort of like the cool dad of the girl you're trying to date. Like, you go over to pick her up and Dave Grohl answers the door and you're like, oh, your dad's super cool. We could just hang out here. You know, like, we don't have to go out anymore. So I think as far as people who are still alive, who are Gen X icons, I had Dave Grohl. Pipe, who do you have for this one?
Oh, man. I feel like Rob Lowe is in there as well. And I realize that's going to make so many Gen Xers cringe. But in terms of living icons, I feel like he has to be up there. It, in a similar way to Dave Grohl, in that he's morphed into a bunch of different things without aging at any point. I don't totally know how he's pulled that off. He and Paul Rudd apparently are on the same sell their soul to the devil vitamin regimen to stay young. But yeah, I would pick Rob Lowe, I think.
That's a great one, dude. Big R, who you got for this?
Gosh, I don't know, man. You guys know how bad I am at this. I'm trying to think of, my mind immediately went to some actors, kind of like Pipe. Really, Grohl is a great one, actually. I mean, he embodies so many different things, doesn't he? And he, you know, kind of how he, I mean, you know, he came out of, you know, one of the most iconic Gen X, maybe the iconic Gen X, you know, band of all time because of how it all went down for him. And then, but he's a survivor. So to be honest, you know, Kurt Cobain wasn't very Gen X-y at all because he ended up not being very resourceful. What a horrible thing to say, right? But but Grohl is a survivor. Yeah. And he just kind of kept maintaining and never give up. And before he knows it, he's just the most successful rock star in the world. Yeah. And yet, It has nothing to do with his music. He's just a personality. I mean, Dave Grohl is essentially a more palatable Kardashian. I mean, it doesn't matter if he makes records. It doesn't matter what he does. People love him. They want to be around him. They want to be around him because they actually like him, though, because he has a magnetic personality. Sure. And he is the reason why I'm going off on that. Number one is because I can't think of anybody else. And number two, I think he embodies like what Gen Xers would have dreamed of being on that side of the Gen X scale, right? On the Bender side, that would have been his dream to someday turn into Dave Grohl.
Dude, totally. That's high ceiling Bender right there.
100%.
You're a little bit of a rebel. You're a little bit of a bad boy in high school, but then you end up being Dave Grohl. You're like a billionaire and everyone likes you. Absolutely. I've got a Kurt Cobain question, and then I got a couple more Gen X icons to run by you guys. Here's my Cobain question, and we can get both of you on it. If he had lived, what would his arc have been? Because Kurt Cobain, and he was one of the few people who took this position who I really believed. I truly believe Kurt Cobain was at odds with fame. And yet, he was one of the most famous people in the 90s. You know, really good looking, really charismatic, really good at his job. He was a great rock star. But what would his arc have been? I don't think he would have turned into, like, kind of palatable elder statesman like Dave Grohl. He wouldn't have turned into, like, warm and fuzzy good hang like Dave Grohl. What would his arc have been? Do you guys have thoughts on that?
Oh, man. Go ahead, Pat.
I was going to say, it's hard to think of anybody who is that sort of ideologically intense who ages well. Mm-hmm. They either become the sellout that they hate, which then becomes more palatable, or they fade into obscurity, or they have a tragic end. I mean, there's no, you can't be ideologically opposed to what you are and age well. Mm-hmm. I don't think.
That is true.
I'm trying to think of anybody in any other field who's done it well. Like, actors who absolutely abhor fame end up, like, they just get chased around by the paparazzi until they punch somebody and go to jail or whatever. Like, there's it, or they collapse in on themselves.
Well, I think Cobain would have grown his fame, and because of his influence, he would have done it in a way that made sense for him. So I look at Cobain as becoming the Gen X Neil Young at this juncture in his life, kind of a thing.
That's a good one.
Where he's still singing about things that he's upset about that have not gone well in his life, or he's kind of become elder statesman of, you know, kind of being able to look, you know, kind of like judging the culture and, you know, being the cultural observationist and just kind of, you know, releasing Kurt Cobain records because Nirvana probably would have been done years and years ago. And then, you know, and then just kind of becoming like one of the most respected, like elder statesmen of rock and roll, like that the world has ever known. I think the more fascinating thing about that is that I don't think you have a Dave Grohl at this point.
No, you're right. If Cobain lives,
there's no Foo Fighters. Yeah, I don't believe in it.
Yeah. No, you're so right, dude. You don't have a Dave Grohl. He never gets to like flourish as
Dave Grohl just becomes a drummer for another band. You know, and that's what he fades into obscurity.
No, I really like the Neil Young arc for Cobain. I had another arc for him that's similar but a little bit different.
Yeah.
I think in another scenario, he takes the like old hipster title strap from Tom Waits. Like he shows up in a Jim Jarmusch picture every 3 years, like smoking a cigarette, and you're like, oh my gosh, there's Kurt Cobain. And he you know, plays a show once every 5 years or whatever. And he kind of takes that old hipster strap from Tom Waits. But
yeah,
he'd be like Tom Waits, but he's way more successful. He would have been hard for him to do that. But.
Yeah, he'd be more like grunge rocker Willie Nelson.
Oh,
yeah. And that's Neil Young, a.k.a. Neil Young. You know,
No, that's good. Yeah, those are all really good.
Well, one other thought on Cobain. I think if he was like the best thing for him, obviously, had he lived, would have been to get into the, in terms of sort of musically and managing things, get into the circle of somebody like Rick Rubin, who is just the most zen, appreciates where anybody's coming from, and has worked with everybody from like hip hop artists to Johnny Cash to who like Nine Inch Nails to whoever, and would be able to sort of level him out and be like, let's channel your 100%. Energy, that kind of thing would have worked well for him.
He missed that, you know. That's a really insightful point. Cobain needed a mentor. He was an isolationist, and if somebody could have like stepped like a Rubin, could have said, "Hey, buddy, we're gonna figure this out. I'm gonna be your friend. You don't have to give up your music, your art. You can get out of the public eye. You know, like let me help you work some of these things out. But don't give up. Let's get you some medical help too. You needed some legit medical help. And I think, yeah, there is a future for Cobain, but man, everything that had happened in his life up to that point made it really hard for him not to end up where he ended up. You know, it's one of those, it's sad, you know, but
yeah, absolutely. Well, I think not having a mentor though was kind of a young Gen X core value.
Yeah, you know, I mean, for sure, 100%.
Being an isolationist was sort of part of the sex appeal of Gen X.
Well, know? And then like, you don't write Smells Like Teen Spirit if you're not an isolationist, you know, so it's
yeah, exactly.
Par for the course, yeah, you know? Yeah.
Those two things are fundamentally at odds with each other.
100%,
and
yeah.
That's what kind of gets interesting when you think about anybody who makes art, right? So like, if they have a mentor, the art fundamentally changes. But maybe they end up being a healthier person, or a more satisfied person, or even just a less lonely person. But maybe we don't get necessarily the art that they were capable of. I had another Gen X icon. I want to run this person by you guys. Ethan Hawke. Mm. Like, when I think about the four or five most iconic Gen X things, like the Richard Linklater Before Sunrise movies, the movie Reality Bites, where he plays like the kind of greasy, you know, 90s hair stoner philosopher Troy Dyer character, that like
Troy is the most Gen X name ever, by the way.
Oh, Troy is a great Gen X name. It's fantastic. But like Ethan Hawke playing those characters at that time, like my wife thought that type of person was so hot back then.
That's so
but
funny.
nobody thinks that type of person is hot now. You know, like kind of stoner philosopher as a persona to have in college is completely over. And even back then, like the moment you walk across the stage and collect your diploma, you become 33% less hot. You know, it's a persona that only worked like in college in the 90s. But Ethan Hawke was sort of emblematic of that kind of guy. What do you guys think?
No, man, that's really funny. I love, yeah, Ethan Hawke was, the problem with Ethan Hawke was this is what was great and not great about him. Ethan Hawke embodied a type from mm-hmm. that era, but he was mm-hmm. a type that in real life I couldn't stand. So yeah. all the Ethan Hawkes of my life were never my friends. I just wanted those guys to go away because go he ahead. Wasn't like, he wasn't the, here's the thing, like he wasn't a, he was an intellectual bully is what he was.
Oh, totally.
And and I just, that type just drove me up the wall. And like he thought he was smarter than he really was. He thought he was smarter, but every time he opened his mouth, he sounded dumb. But what he said kind of proved that he was the goal was to be a thinker, right? And so when I watch Ethan Hawke, I go, oh man, he nailed it. He's a great actor. All of that stuff, but he reminded me of all the people I couldn't stand in my high school years. So I have a funny relationship with Ethan because I actually like him, but I actually can't stand him at the same time. You know?
Yeah, that's really good. Pipe, what was your experience? You were at Wheaton, let's say early 2000s, right?
Yeah.
Was like hot stoner philosophy guy, like still a persona that was working then, or was that over?
Or is it even allowed to eat at Wheaton?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been like faux stoner. It would have been people who like snuck clove cigarettes behind the dorm when people weren't looking, like that
totally
that version. Those of you who did that, you know who you are.
Jarums, baby, gotta shout out Jarums.
Yeah, it had. I would say it had more of like a beat poet thing at Wheaton, where because there's such class tiers there. There's the Patagonia vest crowd. There's the like crunchy granola ultimate frisbee crowd. There's the and then there was the philosopher types. And then there was a few of us who were like, I just want to play pickup basketball and maybe go to class if somebody makes me. So it kind of worked, but it was all very, it had a very high school vibe there where there's the groups of people and they don't really mix that much.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. And a Christian university would have way more of a high school vibe in general because there were restrictions and things you can and can't do. kind of a thing.
Well, and, and everybody was the sort of the king of the castle when they came in. Like, they were, all of us were among the top in our high schools. Like, that's just the nature of a sort of academically, you know, elite school. And so it has to fall into classes because everything's competitive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and to your earlier point, Bigar, about Ethan Hawke, I do think faux depth was a core value of the 90s. A core value of Gen X was like appearing to be a thinker, wanting people to think you're deep, which again, nobody's hung up on that anymore. You know,
Isn't
that just what influencers do now? Motivational people, you know, the people who are get out there, rise and grind. Isn't that just faux depth? Because if you think about what they say, what they're really saying is your motivation should be get motivated. And then they just spin it into 1,000 different TikTok videos. Like it's all the same stuff, just new brand.
That seems fundamentally vapid to me though. And maybe it's my Gen X-ness that's like reading that experience as vapid. But maybe to them it's depth or faux depth or whatever. And it's, here's what I think it is, Pipe. And you help me with this. Like, I think in the same way that faux depth helped Gen Xers sort of reckon with their meaningless lives, I think in the same way, these influencers are trying to imbue fundamentally meaningless lives with meaning. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. Like that's exactly. Yeah. I mean, the idea of like you have a job you hate, but go out there and you know kill
crush it.
Yeah. Back to the violent imagery for what we do to our jobs. And I think that's exactly what it is. But so instead of like sitting around reclining on a ratty floral couch pontificating, you know, you're up doing burpees at 4:45 a.m. so that you can be the next, you know, the next entrepreneurial whiz kid.
Yeah, gosh, that's fascinating.
And they both sound horrific to me, by the way. I don't want to be in either of those circumstances.
You're too old. You're too old to want to be in those circumstances, Pipe. I mean, you've hit the...
Yeah. Exactly. They do sound horrific.
Because they're not very comfortable, guys. And as you get older, you just want to wear sweats. You know, you want to be a little... You want to be the sweats-wearing version of Deep, right? It's...
You do. You want to wear sweats. You want to sit on a nice couch.
100%, man. 100%. Yeah.
And even the like horsepower that it takes to sound deep and be deep. I don't know. Like just thinking about that makes me tired. But
I mean, dude, Cobain would be wearing sweats right now. Let's just keep that in mind. He'd be sitting in his mansion wearing sweats a lot right now. You know,
and good for him. I would want that for him. You know,
Francis Bean's going to have his grandkids. Dude, that's remember where he'd be right now. You know,
yeah, I wouldn't have wanted Cobain to remain miserable forever. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like if he was still walking around in like, you know, dirty T-shirts with a torn neck, you know, at age, you know, 48 or whatever, he would be right now.
Miserabilism is really unattractive for like anybody over like 30 years old at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah, why was it so attractive for like us in our 20s in the 90s? It's so strange that like being miserable and angsty was fashionable. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Because
it makes no sense.
It's sold. Yeah. It was our generation's brand of authenticity, right? So it's like we're not afraid to complain about the things that our parents have been propping up as God, and we're saying no, that actually sucks. You guys are actually bankrupt. You're wrong about that. But the thing that we're going to hold up in place of it is just as bankrupt, but it's new and it's selling right now. And
it's ours.
You know, I'm a loser baby. Why don't you kill me? You know, it's that whole thing, right? It's like, what's the difference? It's the same thing, just a different, it's the same wall with different wallpaper. You know?
Yeah. So self-indulgence of a different variety.
100%.
Yeah. And I guess today the stand-in is I'm anxious, I'm depressed. So instead of leading with I'm anti whatever my parents' generation stood for, you know, the sort of vulnerability or the approachability comes via these are my mental health issues.
Yeah, is like anxiety is the new cynicism.
That's right.
Oh, that's uncomfortably right. That's uncomfortably real. I'm very uncomfortable with how much you just hit the nail on the head.
I'm very uncomfortable with what I just said, Pipe. Don't worry. I'm with you. Don't worry about it.
No, it's so spot on true. I mean, this is going to sound like a digression, but it's very much on point. So we, a couple of people from our church staff just went to a big meeting where there was a bunch of research laid out by the Barna Group, you know, this church research group, looking at sort of the health of the city, the state of the city, and they do it per, you know, per region. So they did one for Nashville. And Nashville is something like 15% more anxious than the average American city, which makes total sense because it's a performative city and it's a young city. And so you put those two things together and I'm like, it is absolutely our generation's disaffected cynicism is to be anxious, is to be, it's the water in which, you know, younger millennials, Gen Z swim. So it's not even it's not a posing thing. It's just the air that is breathed. And so until you sort of help them see, no, this isn't actually normal. It's not necessary. It's 100% true. And I had never thought about that generational sort of parallel. And it's very striking.
It's not a posing thing, but it is sort of a requirement to wear the uniform. Like you kind of have to lead with a little bit of anxiety. Because if you walk into a room and you're really self-assured.
Yeah, there it is.
That doesn't play well. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, anxiety. Anxiety gets you. Like it.
It gets you places. It opens some doors.
It's acceptance. Yeah. Right? In that sense. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a credit card. It's accepted everywhere.
Well, it
you
is.
Know?
It is a more vulnerable form of cynicism, is what it is.
I got a hot take. I miss cynicism.
Well,
here's the thing.
I don't think you ever left it behind, Ted. I don't think you can miss a thing that you. I don't think you can miss a thing that you just have.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're absolutely right. But I do think it got boring, you know. And I think by the end of the '90s, it got so boring.
Well, it was marketed.
Yeah. Well, and in the same way that anxiety is getting boring, you know. I mean, we're about 5 to 8 years into the everybody's anxious thing, and it's about to be over.
I mean, the thing is, like, there was, you know, the thing, there was a lot of people doing this, but you always look at the people that rose to the top, right, in a commercial way, and Cobain did. And so, I mean, there was plenty of, like, cynical, quote-unquote, like, music and art being made, and he just hit something. It's way too long to get into all that. But he hit on something, and then you see sort of, like, the stream that followed Nirvana. I'm just talking about music, too, but, like, the stream that kind of followed Nirvana, and, like, by the you know, 4 years later, by the time you get to like Green Day, you know, you're just like going, oh, so cynicism is just, that's what we do now. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Like however authentic it is. And I'm not saying Billy Joe Armstrong wasn't authentic. I actually think he was, but it was like, oh, but this is still working for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's selling. It's good to be cynical is the point. Right.
Dude,
it's
what
profitable.
What artist represented the end of that? Like, what was the end of cynicism?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'm trying to think of some of the changes. Some of the changes in the '90s. I think it was when we had the return of a lot of the boy band stuff by the end of the '90s. Was probably like, hey, we just want to feel good again. We just want things don't have to be deep. Things don't have to be. I remember reading about that shift too. I remember it's so funny you say that, T, because I remember when they were writing articles about that, like, hey. Everything doesn't have to like double down into, you know, the state of the world and how horrible everything is. We can just enjoy the moment, celebrate life a little bit. And that it was kind of, you know, late '90s is what I feel like there was a shift there, but I don't know.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
vague.
No, that's good. I have a bridge between that and cynicism, and it was '90s Bono. Cause Bono was the one who kind of never swam in the cynical waters. He was always kind of earnest, and so he may have like dragged our generation out of cynicism, and then the boy bands just finished the job. But fascinating stuff. Anybody else on Gen X icons for either of you?
Take a pipe.
Man, I'm just trying to think of, I mean, there's, to me, Gen X is, I mean, it's music and film, which is what we've talked about largely. Like, if you try to think about Gen X entrepreneurs, you know, it kind of flies in the face of the whole ethos. There's this,
right.
You know, they're just sort of like, you know, they didn't have the angst and the cynicism because they were trying to build something as opposed to trying to oppose something or be disaffected. So, I mean, I'm sure that, that there were a ton of really successful entrepreneurial business people, especially in the tech world, you know, like, but that gets associated with millennials. So, I don't,
I guess like Mark Cuban, you know, like would be one, but it's a short list.
And I guess there's an opposition there because maybe in the finance world, you know, people who did different things in the market and weren't just sort of the white collar schlubs of the, of their parents' generation. But none of that sounds Gen X. That all sound like Gen X as a brand is faux deep, is cynical, is grungy, is whatever. And it's all on the more creative side, not on the like productive member of society side.
Yeah. Honestly, the rappers of that era did it the best. Like if you look at the pantheon of like musicians who became massive successful brands and business people without really selling out whatever it was that made them special to begin with. I mean, like Dr. Dre is at the top of that list, right?
Yes.
You know, still massive amounts of respect in the industry, but like started a bunch of kind of different companies and projects and made billions of dollars, but retained this sort of artistic
credibility. And hip hop bridged the gap from generations because that was like that stuff got big in the early 90s, which is kind of pre-millennial. Millennials being the primary market. So, you know, Tupac, Biggie, all of the heyday of hip hop was when I was sort of middle school, high school, like becoming in a, you know, a buyer. So that means Gen X was the market and it worked. And so, and those guys were way like they carried on the legacy of Kurt Cobain, sort of anti-protest, cynical storytelling, way more than any rockers did. You know, Ronnie brought up Green Day. They felt very drony after a while. It's like, oh, you're whining again.
I was completely bored with Green Day.
Yeah, like from day one.
There were so many bands like that. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas hip hop felt very different. It felt much more, I don't know, raw and authentic. Okay, so here's another Gen X icon for you. Mm-hmm. Totally shifting gears.
Yeah.
Mark Driscoll.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. He had the kind of look and feel of a Gen X icon, traded on cynicism, traded on being anti.
Traded on being in Seattle, which is like home of grunge.
Right. Home of Gen X. Yeah. Gen X epicenter. And everyone liked it until they realized they didn't like it. You know, which is sort of
until this is a little bit like what we talked about, what I said with Cobain. If you have somebody who's that ideologically angsty and opposed, they don't age well unless they change. And he became both a kind of sellout to power, but also remained ideologically opposed, which just made him, you know, ministerially tyrannical. But I mean, like in terms of the generation expressions, like if you think back on the church during that era, the successful churches were all very boomery. You know, it was the Rick Warren branded kind
Bill
of thing.
Hybels.
Willow Creek, that kind of stuff. North Point with Andy Stanley. Although I think Stanley might technically be Gen X. But I mean, it was that model, and then you have this counterculture kind of church. And Driscoll was just the most prominent example of it. So I would put him up there as a like Gen X church icon, which, you know, doesn't say much for that particular season of evangelicalism for icons.
Dude, it's so true. And you know, even the flip side of that is all the emergent church guys who kind of are all Gen Xers, who all kind of burned out and sort of crumbled under the weight of their own, you know, anti-ideologies. That didn't go well. But you made a fascinating point near the top of the show, like trying to think about examples of people who were really ideologically intense, but who turned out okay. And it's all people who were really walking closely with the Lord. Like, that's the only category of that working out okay. So, like, somebody like your dad, who's not Gen X, but, you know, super, super intense dude ideologically. If your dad had been the same type of person, but his ideologies had been, liberal politics, and he didn't know the Lord, he would have turned into a horrible person, you know, politics, and he didn't.
He probably would have been like a small liberal arts school professor who was dearly beloved and deeply hated by the student body, depending on which portion of the student body you were talking about. That's the direction for somebody with the level of kind of intensity that he has, and the level intellectual rigor,
horsepower. And that character would have been so bitter and so mad at the world by the time they're playing a liberal arts professor at like Bard College in a Noah Baumbach movie, they're drinking 2.5 bottles of wine to fall asleep at night, and that they're just a certain kind of character. But as far as that kind of ideological intensity going, well, it's all people who have really had their hearts changed by the Lord. And, you know, it's probably a good note to end on, right? Like, for all the kind of posturing that Gen X brought to the table, at the end of the day, any of this working only works, you know, if our hearts are truly regenerate and different. Anything else you want to add, Pipe? This is a fun one.
Yeah, it was. This one had a little more life to it than some of the others, because it's obviously you and Ronnie sit squarely in Gen X, and I'm adjacent enough to have a foot in that world. Whereas, like, talking about Gen Z, it's very much more like we're the old people observing and trying to weigh the good and the bad. And then millennials are kind of the in between, and I'm sort of one of them too. But yeah, I think what always strikes me when we talk generations is just, it is so easy to be negative. There's always the sort of throw in like, yeah, but they're not going to ruin the world because nobody has, kind of thing. You know, like with Gen Z. Gen Z is going to be fine, and they're going to be us in 30 years. Like 30 years from now, they're going to be owning suburban homes, and they're going to be, for better or worse, comfortable adults. And that's always the arc of things. And we hyper-focus in on I think Gen X got this the worst, and that's part of the cynicism, is that after the boomers, they were so reactive that it was a little bit like people responding to hippies. Like, these people are insane. Totally. And millennials have gotten some of that, but also millennials have always just been like, we don't care what you think, and we're going to go make money. And Gen X was like, no, we're going to fight you. And so there was a lot more angst.
Yeah, millennials don't, like, engender a strong response in anybody. Like, the most you're moving the needle as a millennial is just like mild annoyance.
Not anymore, but you have to remember 10, 12 years ago, millennials were going to ruin the workplace. They're not motivated. They're only looking out for themselves. They switch jobs every 18 months. You know, I remember when I worked at Moody Publishers, millennials was like a byword. And then we started a publishing line that was aimed at millennials, or not a publishing line, but sort of an acquisitions team getting books aimed at, and it was a profound generational gap, because the average age of employee there was like 50, and millennials at that point were like 25, 20. So I mean, you're talking a full
50
generation
is generous.
Gap. Yeah.
Because I was publishing with Moody back then, and it was an old roster,
right?
Editorially, let's just say that.
And so what we have lost, like, I would love to go recall the millennials are ruining the marketplace and bring those things to light now and review our current situation in light of that. And I'm sure that there was plenty of accurate criticisms. And I'm also sure that we have not ruined the world. We're doing okay. Generally, like, we're growing up, we're raising kids, we're making the same mistakes our parent did in some ways and different ones in other ways. But Gen X was the whipping boy. I remember being a kid, and kids don't pay attention to anything, but I remember hearing about this thing called Gen X and basically thinking they sound kind of cool and also kind of scary because they're ruining everything. And this is me as like an 8-year-old.
And there was all this like stark imagery of like, I don't know, Eddie Vedder going on like the Walter Cronkite show to get interviewed by this like old man in a suit. And Eddie Vedder's wearing like a, I don't know, like a torn up like Mudhoney t-shirt. And, you know, the imagery of that couldn't be any more stark, you know, and like you don't have dynamics like that anymore. But yeah, you're right. I remember that being a thing too, where, you know, Gen Xers are going to ruin everything, and then millennials are going to ruin everything. And yeah, I'm sure, I guess we'll be saying it about Gen Z, you know, soon, but, I don't know.
No, we can't say anything negative about Gen Z. That's not allowed.
Yeah. I certainly can't in the college business. I mean, they're the best. They're all the best.
They're wonderful.
Just ask them. Pipe, we've done what we always do on this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout Gen X. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
If you're hearing this right now, you're probably like, who the heck is this? And why are they playing during my favorite podcast? And I get it. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I do want to introduce myself. My name is Trevor Tyson, and I'm the host of Trevor Talks, where we talk to real people about real topics and real stories. I just want to invite you, if you love podcasts, if you love music, if you love books and love hearing from the people who create it, come check us out at Trevor Talks. Simply go to Google or Life Audio, type in Trevor Talks, and it'll pop on up. Hope you have a great day.